To call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order is 1:30 PM on Monday, March 30th, 2026. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary. She makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings. And Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Tilton, Senator Stevens, Senator Tobin, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. The first and only item on our agenda is Senate Bill 249, Virtual Currency Kiosks, sponsored by Senator Tilton. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today, we're going to be taking invited and public testimony for Senate Bill 249. I want to note online, in addition to the folks we're going to have for invited and as well as public testimony, Matt Moore, an officer from the Palmer Police Department, is available online. Director Tracy Reno, Division of Banking and Security, is available online. Autumn Miller, Acting Chief of Examiners, Division of Banking and Security, is online. And looks like Ian Engelbeck, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, is also online. I want to first go to invited testimony, and first I'd like to go to Clara Wolfson, who I believe is here in the room. Ms. Wolfson, if you would please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and identify your affiliation, and you may begin your remarks. I'd ask you to keep your prepared remarks to no more than 3 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, thank you for having me today. My name is Clara Wolfson, and I am Legislative Counsel for CoinFlip, a cryptocurrency kiosk company. I'm here today really to tell you one thing, and that is that this bill will put us out of business in Alaska. We have 7 machines in the state already. We have about 1,000 customers over the last couple years that we've been doing business, and we would really like to continue doing business here. So I would urge you to thoughtfully consider some amendments, because we fully support the spirit of this bill. I want to make that clear, and that is consumer protection, right? But there is a middle ground here that is available that would protect consumers, but also responsibly regulate us and allow us to do business while still providing financial access options for people who don't otherwise have the option to purchase cryptocurrency through a traditional format. A couple of things I want to make sure we touch on. I know you mentioned that there was a police department on the line. We actually have a full-time law enforcement coordinator, a director, rather, of communications, who it's his job to go throughout the country and train police departments and law enforcement agencies on how to prosecute these crimes, because that's one thing that we're really seeing, concerns around these machines pick up. There's some scam numbers that we've heard. We wholeheartedly disagree with how large they've gotten, but I want to make sure that everyone listening knows that there are resources available. We want to be a good actor and a responsible operator, and urge you to consider some of the measures that have passed in 20 other states that would allow us to continue to do business here in Alaska. Thank you, and happy to answer any questions.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you talk to us about those measures that have passed in other states, what they do?
Yeah, absolutely. So this bill would limit our fee caps that, depending on which version you're looking at, either 2 or 3%, and limit our transactions, our daily transaction volume, anywhere from $1,000 a day to $500 a day. Now, most states have taken a bifurcated approach, and that's really important. We support lower limits for new users, because new users have the highest risk of falling victim to some of the issues that we've heard raised. However, there is reporting requirements that we need to meet on the federal level, namely filing suspicious activity reports, currency transaction reports. That's our compliance obligation as a money service business registered with FinCEN. So we encourage those transaction limits to be lower for new customers and then higher for existing customers who we've worked with, we know, we've identified. So that is one of the main things, is the transaction limit differentiation between new customers and existing customers, along with refund distinctions for new and existing customers. But I also want to stress the fee cap. So this would be the lowest fee cap in the country. There's only one other state that currently has a fee cap of 3%, and that is Maine. We have machines in Maine, but they are shut off right now as we work on a fix to that bill. Most states are in the neighborhood of 15 to 18% if they have a percentage specified in statute at all. So those are really those three things are the bulk of where we differentiate. We support pretty much everything else in the bill in terms of consumer protections. But some of the things that I want to stress in terms of things that states have, other states have done, is requiring those consumer protections without going so far as to put us in a little bit of a pinch, or just honestly straight up conflicting with federal law requirements and what is expected of us at that level as well.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions, and you said that you act as general counsel for CoinFlip. Is that correct?
Legislative counsel. Legislative, yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I'm curious, as the other states in which you operate, do they have equal protection clauses or laws within their constitution?
That's a great question. I'm happy to get you some of that information. I know, for example, in Iowa, because I'm from Iowa, we do, and we operate there, and they have a 15% fee cap in their law and lots of other consumer protections, but we've been able to work with them to get the bill in a more favorable spot to allow us to still operate.
Follow-up?
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm particularly interested in this concept, and I see in some of the other public testimony that we've received is in treating new users and existing users differently. I am by no means a lawyer, but I have received enough legislative legal opinions from our nonpartisan lawyers here in the Alaska State Legislature that often indicate that under equal protection clauses, there has to be a very strong state interest to treat people differently. And I just don't understand why we would treat a new user differently than an existing user and create different mechanisms for either group.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to speak to that. So usually those distinctions are based on something that is a little more inherent to your identity, say maybe race or gender or things like that. And laws that differentiate on the basis of that kind of identity are absolutely given a higher amount of scrutiny. However, laws that are rationally related to the purpose that they're trying to solve, like new user versus existing user, as long as those distinctions are meant to serve the public, they're actually held up fairly frequently. Police powers of the state often treat people differently based on their inherent risks. And things like new versus existing users is something that we are supportive of. And we would have no issue, you know, if the state chose to go that route, we would encourage that because that's really what protects the most vulnerable groups that we see.
Follow up?
Just when you say held up, you mean that they're found that the laws are constitutionally permissible within equal protection provisions?
Absolutely, Counselor. Right.
Thank you.
That would be the chair, not the counselor, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. And I guess I just don't understand what the public interest would be is in, particularly in one of the pieces that we've received, is this idea that new users could receive a refund up to a full refund up into 30 days, and yet existing users would not receive a full refund. They'd only have their fees refunded within 7 days. I just don't understand what the public interest in that particular provision might be and some of the others that I've seen outlined in our public testimony. So I'd be curious, or I'd be happy if you would follow up offline to explain to us what you think is a fair approach to new and existing users that does protect the public interest, which in my personal opinion, that is not a provision at all that would do that.
Would you like to?
Please.
Yeah,
we'd like the response here
Yeah, I'm happy to respond to that. So specifically on the fees, that's really because how our business operates and the inherent fluctuations that happen in the value of cryptocurrency make it more prone to consumers changing their minds after a purchase, right? So the way that our business operates is we're strictly a third-party intermediary. We take our own stock of cryptocurrency and sell it directly to a consumer. So let's say we have an existing user relationship with a customer established. They've been transacting with us for a few years. They know us. They understand cryptocurrency. They purchase some Bitcoin, for example, and let's say the price of Bitcoin absolutely goes, you know, tanks one day to the next. That consumer could change their mind, and if you offer an existing customer a full refund, then us as a company would be on the hook for that difference in value. And that's why we advocate for treating those new and existing users differently. Because if you know and understand cryptocurrency, you also understand that there's risks, especially in the fluctuation of value. And we don't believe that the company should be left with making up the difference.
Follow up?
Senator Tilton. Tobin, I'm sorry.
Thank you. It happens when you're between two T's.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Particularly challenging for me because my name has two T's and I get stuck between them all the time.
Thank you. And I appreciate that explanation. I'm just to confirm, your company works within the Bitcoin community, which is very volatile, and you choose to operate within this particular sector, understanding the full and associated risk with that.
Yeah, so we offer multiple different kinds of cryptocurrency, about 10. Like I said, we sell our own stock of cryptocurrency. So we also take on risk when that happens because we have to purchase our cryptocurrency on the open market. So we also, like I said, take on risk when we decide to do that to then sell it. So yes, we understand that it is a very risky and volatile environment, and there are multiple places where we could lose money.
Thank you.
Senator Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does your company provide different levels of, let's say, like you could belong to a certain level of club in buying your cryptocurrency and purchasing that?
So we don't have a club necessarily, but we call them tiers. And the tiers are assigned to customers based on their risk level and the type of currency they're wanting to purchase and the transaction amount. So those tiers require different information for different amounts or different demographic factors based on our Know Your Customer requirements that we have developed in-house.
I follow up. So those, so your tiers require different levels of your fee. What would your highest fee be that you would have at a higher risk?
So the fee doesn't differentiate based on tiers at a kiosk. We do have different products. For example, we have an online service. And if you use our over-the-counter desk, there's just less physical infrastructure that is needing to be supported with those kinds of purchases. So there's a smaller fee on those. At a kiosk, however, there's different levels of information you'll have to provide for a higher amount, a higher transaction amount. We're going to require more information from you, but that does not lower the fee that you pay. We at CoinFlip, I can't speak for other operators, charge a flat fee on our transactions, and that is very clearly disclosed to consumers both before and after a transaction, because one of the things we support in this bill, and I want to make sure it's clear, is that the definition of charges in the bill ensures that any spread in the price of crypto, for example, is included in the markup of the fee, so a consumer knows what they are paying for and what they're getting.
Thank you.
So I hear your criticism about the 3% fee cap. Is the minimum fee cap that you believe, reasonable that would allow you to stay in business 15%?
Yes.
And compare that 15% fee. If I go down to Western Union and I want to transfer $1,000 to a relative in another state, what's Western Union going to charge me as a percentage, if you know?
That's a great question. What I can say is I have looked into pretty extensively currency exchange booths at airports.
Okay.
Because, it, you know, whether you think of it as a commodity or a currency, those currency exchange services often exceed that in the spread that they charge between the originating currency and the exchanging currency.
So just by way of example, if I'm standing at the Anchorage Airport and there's a currency exchange kiosk there and I've just come in from England, so I want to change British pounds to American dollars, you're saying that the currency exchange fee to feed in my British pounds is going to be more than 15%?
Correct. Most
Can you
often,
give me
yeah.
a typical range you see for the currency exchanges?
We've seen anywhere from 10 to 50%. And, you know, once again, different operators do it differently. But a lot of exchange operators will say, oh, we charge a $2.99 fee, but then actually make their money in the spread price difference. Once again, that's why we believe in fair and transparent disclosures. So our fees are higher, but that's inclusive of everything.
And so when you talk about a currency exchange and the spread price difference, you're saying that they may charge a $3 fee, but if you compare the currency exchange rate on the open market versus what the kiosk is offering me, I'm paying a higher fee because I get a worse rate on my exchange than I would get on an open market exchange.
Correct. Much higher.
And then turning to the transaction limits, what is your perspective? What is a reasonable new transaction limit then as different from what's in the bill?
So we advocate for a $2,500 new customer transaction limit. And there's a reason we set that
amount. $2,500 a day, a week, or a month?
$2,500 a day.
Okay.
And the reason being is that the federal government has set $2,000 for money service businesses as the threshold for when we file suspicious activity reports. They make it clear that $2,000 is that limit. So $2,500 allows us a little bit of cushion. But really, we would like to hit that $2,000 mark so we can meet our reporting obligations. Because one of the things we've actually seen is that it does help law enforcement. We have received thank you notes from law enforcement agencies saying the reportings that we've filed help not only identify victims, but catch bad actors. If that limit is below $2,000 for a first-time user, law enforcement counterintuitively gets less information to solve some of the very problems that have been raised around these machines.
All right. And how about for existing customers? What is your perspective? Not your recommended. What is a reasonable limit in your eyes for existing customers? And again, I assume this is a per day rate.
Yes, correct. So it's a daily limit. The lowest we would advocate for would be $10,500 for an existing user. And that's once again tied to our reporting requirements. And that is the currency transaction reporting limit. And at that amount per day, we're collecting things like your social security number. We're verifying your proof of funds. We're doing the reporting with the federal government. And it provides us an opportunity and information for law enforcement to, like I said, identify victims and bad actors.
I think those are the questions that I had. The reason I'm specifically interested in the existing is I know there are federal currency reporting requirements with banks. And I think in one of your visits, I shared my experience watching a trial involving allegation of multiple efforts to avoid the federal currency reporting requirements with lots of $9,900 deposits. And what you're saying is if you have a $10,000 transaction limit, then people that are getting $9,900 in bitcoins aren't getting reported to the federal government, whereas with a $10,500 limit, those would get reported.
Absolutely, and they do. We filed thousands of currency transaction reports in the last year.
So one of the concerns that we hear about the whole presence of these kiosks is the concern that they're being used for money laundering. As somebody that owns the kiosks, what do you respond to our concerns about these being an avenue for money laundering?
I would say, look, we know that bad actors use our machines as a medium to accomplish their nefarious activities. We will never deny that there are things that happen that we've caught or that we found out about later that do occur here. I think the key to that really is to show what we do to catch it on the back end. So like most financial institutions, we file OFAC checks. So the federal government issues a list of individuals and wallets and bank accounts that we cannot transact with. And we check those OFAC lists. We also have our own internal blacklists that we work with to blacklist individuals. And really, this is where our blockchain analytics comes in. And one thing we're incredibly supportive of is requiring every operator in the state to use blockchain analytics, because that's what that tool is meant to catch, because it catches patterns in the overall public blockchain to see where there could be bad actors and where that money congregates. And it helps identify where some of those transactions could be going. So although it is unfortunate and we know it does happen, there are ways to make sure or ways to improve the outcomes and make sure that those bad actions don't happen at the machines.
Senator Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What percentage of CoinFlip has many platforms? It's not just in the kiosks. It has an online platform as well. So what percentage of the business that CoinFlip has is kiosk business?
Most of our business is done through the kiosks. I would have to look into Alaska specifically because I don't know the number off the top of my head. But we operate in 49 states and 7 countries across the world and have a little over 5,500 machines. So that really is the bread and butter of our business.
But you also do You also do have an online platform that you do business through as well.
Yes.
So there's still an opportunity to do something as long as somebody has the capability of having internet and those things available to them.
Yes, absolutely. I will say one of the things in the bill that we are concerned about is a provision that explicitly applies the limits in the bill to other products that we own, and it says that we cannot use any of those other products to exceed the limits specifically prescribed in the bill. We would advocate for removing that because, as you mentioned, you know, there's different risk tolerances, there's different fees associated with those, and we don't believe that the limits that cover kiosks were necessarily intended to cover other parts of our business model.
And then follow up.
Senator Tilton.
And could you get back with us on how much of your business, percentage of the business is Alaska? I think I asked you that last time when we met.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. I do not see any other questions. Thank you very much for coming back to Juneau today.
Thank you for having me.
Next for invited testimony, we have Louise Myers, Chief Compliance Officer of Hilt Ventures. Ms. Myers, I put yourself on the record, and please make sure you're not on a speakerphone. And I ask you to make your prepared remarks for up to 3 minutes, and then I suspect we'll have questions.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Greetings, Chair Klayman and members of the committee. My name is Louise Paige Myers. I'm the Chief Compliance Officer for Hilt Ventures. We're the largest crypto kiosk operator in Alaska with 36 locations. And we've been operating there for about 2 years, but we've been in business for 8. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. I know that Claire has already set forth a lot of what I'm going to say, so I'm going to keep it brief, but I want to reiterate that we also implement all of the core protections in this bill to the most part and exceed in many respects what's already in there as part of our daily AML policies. Our biggest concern about this bill is we support most of it, but our biggest concern is the refund and transaction limit and the fact that they do not differentiate between new and existing customers. I think I've provided the committee with a redline version that explains what the new definitions, what we believe the new definition should be and the differentiation, but I want to make it clear 99.9% of all scams are first-time customers. They are not existing customers. Because of that, most states that have guardrails, bills like this, or that have enacted bills like this, that do include a differentiation between new and existing. And I like to use Colorado as an example, since that's one of the states that we're in. And for new customers, there's a certain window of time that someone's a new customer. And any time, those new customers are going to get a full refund of the amount of money they put into the machine. Existing customers, we provide the fees. The law in Colorado doesn't say this, but as a matter of practice, most operators do refund fees to customers if the customer can prove through a police report or something else that they've been defrauded. But the new customer gets the full refund. And on the transaction limits, just to kind of piggyback off what was just said, we propose a $2,000 limit, $2,500, we'd be totally fine with that. The reason being, again, these limits of $2,000 or $2,500 versus, $10,500, these are daily limits, new customer versus existing. They're not monthly limits, they're daily limits. And they're because we have certain, requirements that we have to file with the federal government. Different reporting. The other main concern that you guys touched on already is the transaction fee cap. 2% is a ban essentially for our business. Most states that have guardrail laws do not have fee caps, but those that do, the average is about 15%. There's one state I know for sure has a 10%, there's another one that's 18%, but most of them fall right around the 15% range. What we do as a business is very expensive. We're a cash services business. Cash is expensive. We cannot bank in Alaska. I don't know if any of you know that, but cryptocurrency operators cannot have a bank account in Alaska. We have to pay a lot of money to have armed services people come up to Alaska, take the cash out of those kiosks, ship them somewhere out of the state of Alaska into a bank where we can then operate our business and purchase more crypto.
Ms. Myers, I'm going to hold you there. I suspect there are going to be some questions, but you're well past the 3 minutes I asked you to keep your invited testimony.
So. Oh, sorry. I'm
past? Oh, yeah, you were almost to 4 minutes. That's all right. My job is to keep you on time.
Okay, I'll stop. Thank you. Okay.
Question. Okay. Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question, and I just want to make sure that I'm clear. You indicated that for your particular business, that even an existing user who can prove that they were defrauded or had a fraudulent transaction would not receive a full credit or refund. They would only receive a refund of their fees. Is that what you indicated?
Correct. And in practice, 99.9% of anybody that's ever in 8 years reported a scam has been a first-time customer. So over time, our AML policies change, and they get more restrictive, and they change as criminal activity changes. And so in the beginning, we weren't putting holds on first-time customers. We weren't really considering a differentiation between the first-time and existing. But because of the patterns that we've seen, and that the ability of compliance software to do more now than it could 8 years ago, we're able to hold first-time customers. And then because of that, we were able to easily give their money back. We're not out the crypto because we haven't sent it. They get the full amount of cash back. In existing customer scenario, that would be a hypothetical scenario in all honesty, because we don't have that situation anymore because we hold first-time customers. But in the past, when we had customers that maybe did one, two, or three transactions and they reported a fraud, that we did refund their fees at that point, because at that point we didn't have the ability to hold their money. So that's the different, scenario there. And the states that do differentiate, which is quite a few of them, don't have issues. You know, obviously they've acknowledged that there is a difference between new and existing, because the risk profile is different. And as Ms. Wilson from CoinFlip explained, our AML policies, we have to operate as a money transmitter, and everything is risk-based. So based on our risk profile of our customers, a new customer is always the highest risk, or an existing customer who's transacting with us regularly over time has a much lower risk. Just like at the bank, right, or a credit card, they give you a higher limit as you continue to be a customer. It's a similar situation.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also indicate that a credit card or a bank, if you do have a fraudulent charge, would provide you a full credit and refund of the transaction. Would you be opposed to us adding in this legislation a provision that if you are part of the 1% of existing customers who can prove that the transaction was fraudulent, that you receive a full refund?
Well, first of all, banks don't necessarily give you a refund. I've been frauded on Zelle, and I did not get my money back. We just had a customer the other day who was a scam victim. We held his first-time transaction. He got all his cash back, but the cash he lost on Apple Cash, he's not getting back. So that's not necessarily the case that banks or credit cards or any of these other cash services give you your money back. Credit card might be a different thing, but the cash services, the Cash App, the Zelle, the Venmo, you're not getting your money back necessarily. And in terms of the 1% or the 0.1%, I guess, is what you're saying, the way the legislation would have to be pretty buttoned up, because right now it's open-ended, right? It's like 90 days or what is it, like 90 days from the last transaction or 120 days from the last transaction. I mean, if you're talking about an existing customer, as Ms. Wilson was explaining, if you're talking about someone that's been transacting for 5 years and they come back now and say they've been defrauded, that's an entirely different situation than somebody that there's probably not a lot of reliability to that, right? Versus someone that's just come, has never used the machine, is clearly being extorted, scared because they think their relative is in jail or in the hospital or something. So to answer your question, I support the amended language that I suggested to the committee, which is for existing users, a refund of fees. Now, how long that would go out for, that would be more subject to discussion, because I don't think you'd keep it open for, you know, forever. There would have to be a date where you have a certain amount of time to report the scam, right? Because logically, someone would know they've been scammed if it's going on for, you know, forever, I guess.
I will ask you a question that's been on my mind. So, Senator Tilton, in her description of what happened to her mother, has described to me that her mother actually went down as what I would describe as a first-time user and had multiple first-time use events. And it appears that instead of one transaction and no more for some period of time, there were multiple transactions in a short period of time. In the way this law is drafted, is there something that would prohibit her mother from, or a person in a similar situation to her mother, from doing more than one transaction as an initial user?
There is. Okay, so by practice, HILT does more than what this proposed language is stating. So for first-time customers, we hold a first-time customer. And I think I had a discussion with Senator Tilton. It would have been impossible for her mother to have done excessive transactions like that at our kiosk without red flags, bells and whistles going off, the machine shutting down. But you're saying
if she was at a Hilt machine when she made these transactions, you're saying that even without this law passed, she shouldn't have been able to make multiple deposits to purchase Bitcoin. She should have only been able to make one.
And that one would have been held, right? So operators have the ability to hold a first-time transaction. They also have other things they can do in the software, which I'm sure CoinFlip has the same similar capability, but where the machine will, there's patterns. And so you can't do two successive transactions. The same person can't be two successive. Even different people can't do two successive transactions in a row. The machine goes into a cool-off period. And these are things that we've put into place over time as we've detected certain, you know, behaviors of criminal activity. So we have circumvention locks. We have time restrictions. First-time customer holds. These are all things that stop. Her mother wouldn't have been able to get past the first one, even going to a machine nearby. And then her mother's money would have been held, not sent to the criminal. But again, these are all newer things that Bitcoin operators have in their arsenal now. I'm not going to tell you these were available a year ago or 5 years ago. It's like the we've gotten smarter and the software's gotten better at detecting these kinds of things. And so currently today, I'm telling you this wouldn't have happened.
All right. I don't see any other questions for Ms. Myers. Thank you very much for joining us today telephonically. Our last invited testimony is Clark Flint Barr from the American Association of Retired Persons. Ms. Flint Barr, please put yourself on the record. I ask that for your prepared remarks, you limit those to 3 minutes. I imagine there will be questions, so don't worry. You'll probably get a chance to say everything you need after the 3 minutes.
Thank you very much. This is Clark Flint Barr with AARP for the record. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Again, my name is Clark Flint Barr. I'm the Government Affairs Director for Financial Security at AARP. Before joining AARP, I worked for a company that built cryptocurrency investigation software, as well as for the FBI as an intelligence analyst. I mention that to say I've seen this problem from multiple angles, and what we're seeing now in cryptocurrency kiosks is deeply concerning. AARP is very focused on this issue because of what we hear from victims who call the AARP Fraud Watch Network helpline, which gets about 100,000 calls a year. We're hearing from people who were coerced into putting cash into cryptocurrency kiosks over and over and over again, and often over many weeks or many months, unlike what you have heard previously today. What makes the fraud using crypto kiosks so devastating is a combination of three things: the speed with which cryptocurrency moves, the irreversibility of the transactions, and the lack of meaningful state-level safeguards. And recent enforcement actions really highlight how severe this problem is. For example, in Iowa, the Attorney General found that over 94% of transactions conducted with one leading crypto kiosk operator, CoinFlip, were linked to scams. So over 94% of the transactions were scams. For the other leading cryptocurrency kiosk operator in the state, Bitcoin Depot, it was actually worse, over 98%. Of their transactions for linked to scams. So in other words, these machines have become like a near perfect payment tool for criminals. And these are both the top operators in Alaska as well. And these results also align with what many other states have found when they do investigations. So in Alaska specifically, the growth of fraud using cryptocurrency kiosks is very striking. According to the FBI, in 2024, there were 48 reports of crypto kiosk-related fraud with losses of over $900,000. And the year before, there had only been two complaints totaling $37,000 in losses. And that's really such a significant jump in 1 year that should really be a very serious warning sign. And it's also important to understand these numbers are a floor, not a ceiling, because only a small fraction of victims ever report these crimes. So these kiosks are used heavily in tech support scams, government impersonation scams, extortion, investment scams, and in many cases, the victims don't realize what's happened for months, unlike what other folks tonight have said. Frequently, it takes many months for somebody to realize they're a victim of a scam because scammers have gotten so good and so elaborate, and they have AI technology that makes the scam even more convincing than they were before. And I really want to highlight that because you heard earlier that industry would support a bifurcated approach where new and existing kiosk users have different transaction limits. We know from our Fraud Watch Network that this is absolutely not true, that the victims are not realizing very quickly that they have been the victim of a scam and reporting it. The vast majority of the victims we're hearing from who've been sent by a scammer to one of these machines are using them repeatedly. And so a bifurcated approach would not work. And many states that have previously implemented those approaches are now going back and they're amending their bills because that didn't work. Tiered systems based on time or transaction counts have proven very easy for scammers to defeat by coaching victims to wait out new customer periods or reuse wallets to qualify for higher limits. And Minnesota is a state that really illustrates this clearly.
Ms. Flintbar, you're well past the 3-minute time frame. I was trying to keep your preliminary remarks to. I know there are questions from members of the committee. So questions? Maybe Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you. Your comment that only a small fraction of the victims report crimes. What do you know about that? I mean, how can you come up with that statement? I suspect it's true, but how many crimes do we not know of that are not reported?
There are a couple of different sources for that. The Department of Justice put out a report, and we're happy to provide that, where they found that only 10% of victims were reporting. And Gallup has started including questions about whether victims of crimes, including fraud, are reporting to the police. And so we have data from that as well, showing that many people are not reporting. People are very ashamed that they've been victims of fraud. They don't want to admit it. They're worried about losing their financial independence. They're embarrassed. The way that we talk about fraud victims in society, I think, is not conducive to encouraging more people to report fraud. We tend to use language that blames victims in a way that we don't with other types of crimes.
Thank you.
I've got a couple of follow-up questions, Ms. Flintbar. It sounds like you take a different perspective than the representatives of a couple of the different kiosks operator in terms of transaction limits. Is your position with AARP that we shouldn't make a distinction between new and existing users?
No, you should not, because making a distinction between new and existing users has really proven very easy for scammers to manipulate. So they'll do things like give a victim an address that an earlier victim has used. So it looks like, from the kiosk operator standpoint, the wallet address has been used at the machine before. And so this is an existing user. And so then you can allow higher limits to apply. Or they will instruct them to do sort of a test transaction and then go back several days later once the new customer period has ended. Like these folks who are committing these scams, they're doing it over many, many months. They're grooming people for such a long time that they're happy to wait out any type of time limit.
And you also heard some testimony in terms of federal reporting requirements, both in their testimony, for new and existing users, new users of a $2,500 a day limit and existing users of a $10,500 a day limit. If we were to go to a single limit, what is your perspective from AARP, which would be the from your group's recommendation that we what's the limit you would recommend?
Well, I'm very glad that you asked that question, because yes, you heard testimony earlier that suggested that $2,500 should be the limit for new users because SARs are filed at a $2,000 SARs or suspicious activity reports, which are required under the Bank Secrecy Act. And all financial services companies are required to file SARs at $2,000, but you are allowed to file SARs at any level. You can file a SAR on $1 of suspicious activity. So if these companies are not filing SARs on amounts that are less than $2,000, that's a business decision that they have made to not file those SARs. They are, you know, this is something we've taken to FinCEN, and FinCEN has been very clear. They are absolutely allowed and encouraged to file SARs at any amount. So I'm not sure where that argument is coming from, but I certainly didn't agree with that. I also would say, you know, reporting does not protect consumers. At that point, they've lost the money.
Let me go back to the earlier question. If we were to have a per transaction limit, and I'm following, and we followed your advice and didn't distinguish between new and existing users, what is your recommended limit from AARP's perspective?
I'll recommend $1,000 a day for all users. And I would also recommend a monthly limit.
And what is that amount?
$10,000.
All right, and I interrupted I interrupted you. Another thought you were working on because I wanted to get back to those limit amounts. Go ahead with the rest of what you were saying.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I think it really comes down to how much money are you, like, willing to let people have stolen from them? Like, what's an acceptable amount of scam losses? And I just think the numbers that they're proposing are incredibly high. $10,500, that's life-changing amounts of money for most people. And if the argument is that these are being used by people who are unbanked or underbanked, they don't have a need for $10,500 daily limits.
What about the fee amounts? There is a suggestion from both of the other invited testifiers that a reasonable transaction fee was 15%. What's AARP's perspective on that question?
We would support a stronger fee limit. We like the fee limit that's in the bill. I think, you know, when people are scrolling through many pages of disclosures, they do not realize that the average transaction fee that they're paying now is very high, somewhere between 7 and 35%, closer to 25% on average. And that's an incredibly high fee to pay for any financial transaction. If our banks charged that, we would be rioting.
Do you know if I went to the Western Union office and transferred $100 to a friend in another state or a family, what Western Union's fee would be on that?
I think Western Union charges a flat amount, not a percentage, but that's something we can get back to you on.
If you could get back, that would be helpful.
Yes.
Any other questions for Ms. Flint Barr? Senator Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question may not be for you, but I'm going to throw it out here anyway. Do you happen to know the volume of transactions that are actual cryptocurrency purchases versus maybe bill paying activity?
I can jump in there. Very little, like a fraction of a percent of cryptocurrency transactions are things like bill paying or purchases. Some of that has to do with the way that our federal tax structure treats cryptocurrency. So in most cases, people are buying cryptocurrency and holding it as an investment. because if you use it to pay for something, you have to calculate the capital gains or capital losses.
Right. I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. With that, I'm going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 249. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony on Senate Bill 249? Hearing and seeing no one, is there anyone online? Actually, there are some folks online. And we'll start with, looks like Mike Coons. Mr. Coons, if you are on a speakerphone, please don't stay on the speakerphone. If you could, and because it's just not clear if you're on speakerphone, but if you would go ahead and proceed, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Yeah, this is my tennis. I will make it short, sweet, to the point. I think that I'm not a big person on federal and state regulations. I'd like to see the least amount is the best amount. However, with this crypto as new as it is, with a lot of issues are going on with this huge scam aspect to this thing, this is going to be looked at really, really hard. And I think as time goes on and the industry proves it doesn't have to have a lot of these regulations put on them, okay, we can always pull them back. I think for right now, my personal preference is as an investor, I do all my business with Edward Jones. If I want to get into crypto, I'll talk to my financial manager and make that decision. But thank you. I support this bill, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue looks like Phyllis Silverton. Ms. Silverton.
Yes.
Please proceed.
Yes, this is Phyllis Silverton, and I am indeed one of the victims of the scams. I lost $8,000 to the scam that said my daughter was in an accident, blah, 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 and it would take $8,000 to get her clear of it, and I should go to my bank and get the money, and then I should go first. The gentleman said, who identified himself, by the way, as an attorney for somebody in the Juma Police Department, he then told me that I should, that I would probably be going to a courthouse to make this payment. But then when we got back on the line again, he said, no, they weren't available to take that payment, so I should go to a cryptocurrency kiosk, and just happened to be one there at Carr's, and so that's where I went, and I proceeded to use the machine, and I put like $8,000 or more in there to cover it all. It was separate little increments of $900 each increment that they had me put in there. And I think had there been some kind of a big notification on the outside of the machine, first off, to let me know that I should probably stop and think about this, because I lost my brains when they said my daughter was in trouble, that I should probably think about it. If I didn't think about it, then when I got into using it, if there had been maybe another warning that was more than just a whole bunch of little tiny letters that you can't hardly read, and that may have stopped it. I'm not saying it would have, but it may have stopped it. And quite frankly, I was embarrassed. I was grateful that my daughter was not hurt and was not had a problem. I was very grateful for that. But I did lose $8,000, and my $8,000 is equivalent to a year's house payments for me. So I basically borrowed $8,000, which I now have to pay back to lenders. I fully support the bill. I absolutely think that we need way more information out to the public about these scams. A lot of people never heard of them. A lot of people, and I am an elder. I'm 82 years old. And as soon as this happened to me, all of my friends that are also way up there in years got a hold of all their families and said, oh, and everybody was very surprised that something like that could happen here in Alaska. So I thank you for allowing me to testify, and I do support this bill, and I do support everything that the lady from AARP was saying. That's very true. I have all kinds of receipts from my cryptocurrency feeding it the money. I have a big stack of receipts, and those can be provided at any time if anybody wants them. Otherwise, I'll keep them as a reminder. So, thank you very much, and I appreciate being able to testify
Ms. Silverton,
on this subject.
Ms. Silverton, thank you very much for taking the time to testify today. I know from what you said early on that what happened to you is not something you're excited or proud of, and your willingness to actually appear at the hearing today and share your story means a lot to all of us. I know we've all known your daughter in the legislative context for many years. I'm sure she has no questions for you, but I'll ask to see if anyone – actually, she does have a question for you, Senator Tilton.
Thank you. Thanks for testifying today. I know you had lots of things on your schedule, but my question for you is, as far as any kind of follow-up, have you or did you receive any kind of follow-up from the kiosk owners of where the fraud was or anything even back? I know that you filed reports with the FBI and did all the follow-up that you knew that you could do, but have you heard back from anybody?
I have heard back from nobody, and I did file with the FBI, and I also notified the Wausau Police Department, the Juneau Police Department, because that is where supposedly these folks were, although I'm pretty sure now that it's all over, they were probably in Texas or Nigeria or someplace else. Who knows for sure? But yes, I did file immediately with the FBI on that.
Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions, Ms. Silverton. Thank you very much for taking the time to testify today. I wish you the best with the challenges that have resulted from this whole cryptocurrency thing and how it's affected you. But we're certainly thinking of you, and we're keeping an eye on your daughter's new life in the Senate.
Okay, well, thank you.
Next, I'm not sure, is Officer Moore to testify, or is he here strictly for questions?
I do have a question for Officer Moore, if that would be appropriate.
Yes. Officer Matt Moore, I don't think you were – well, you're unclear if you were here for questions or testimony, but Senator Tilton has a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Officer Moore. I appreciate you being online today, and I just was hoping that you could share with the committee that I had – my understanding was that you had taken some of the signage and fraud warnings into your own hands with the Palmer PD, and if you could talk about that and why.
Yes, I'd be more than happy to. Thank you for the chance to. So I became a detective a couple of years ago.
Please state your name for the record. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, my name's Matthew Moore. I work with Palmer Police Department.
Go ahead.
So I became a detective a couple of years ago, and one of the very first cases I got was one of our elder citizens of the city of Palmer that came in and reported fraud, and it was in excess of $15,000. They had put all of the cash into a kiosk to buy cryptocurrency. I had zero power to help the individual, and I started researching from that point. At that point, I found out that a lot of what Ms. Flynn Barr testified to was just absolutely ransacking the elder population of Palmer. So we started doing lunch and learn seminars at the Palmer Senior Center. We put up flyers at all the kiosks. We asked the banks if we could put up flyers to say, hold up, are you on the phone? Is somebody telling you you have a warrant? Please don't put cash in these machines. And we started getting calls after calls after calls. And what we found out was the elder population is being targeted way more than anybody else. I would say the 60-year-olds plus are the prime target. And they're losing their entire life savings to these kiosks, buying cryptocurrency, being told they have warrants or their family members are in danger or they've been injured or they're being sued. And we have no recourse. We have no capability of getting the money back. So I took a few National White Collar Crime Center classes. I took it under my own off-duty time to try to figure out what's going on with this. I worked with a lot of other agencies, and everything Ms. Flynn-Barr says is spot on. I've heard testimony today that says if our transaction fees are above or are below 10%, then we're effectively bankrupt. I would argue that, say, I believe Iowa was what was quoted at 94% fraudulent. If even 50% of the fraudulent transactions are stopped, these kiosks are bankrupt. It has become absurd to me to have 80-year-old individuals that have worked their entire life come into me as a law enforcement officer, and I can do nothing to help them because they put their life savings in a kiosk. We do everything we can, aside from seizing the machine and ripping the cash out of it, to help these individuals. We ask them to report to IC3.gov with the FBI. But these are individuals that they got scammed because they're of a group that doesn't understand technology. If we ask them to go to a website and report fraud, they're going to tell us no. So I agree with Ms. Flynn-Barr that the floor of the reported frauds is what we're hearing. A lot of these individuals are embarrassed, they've lost everything, and they're not going to a website to say, oh, look at me, I gave all my money to a scam. I'm sure you can hear in my voice that I'm a bit emotional about it, but I take it very seriously because I was given a badge to support and defend the Constitution. And this Constitution, as it's currently written, is not protecting our senior citizens from being scammed by a company with fake currency.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Any follow-up questions, Senator Tilton? No. I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. So we are going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 249. And Senator Tilton, any final comments before we hold the bill for further review?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I greatly appreciate the testimony that we had today, and we have a lot to consider, I think, before we come back with maybe the amendment process and see what the bill ends up looking like in the end. My goal is to be sure that Alaskans are not being taken advantage of. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill.
Thank you, Senator Tilton. We are going to adjourn for the day and going to first put Senate Bill 249 aside for further review. We're going to set an amendment deadline for Senate Bill 249 for Friday, April 10th. That is not this Friday, but the following Friday. I'm cognizant that we are not very busy over the Easter weekend, so our amendment deadline is Friday, April 10th at 5 p.m. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, April 1st at 1:30 p.m. We'll be hearing Senate Bill 252, the Uniform Commercial Code, Secured Transactions Electronic Record, sponsored by my office. I would note that it's more pages than the virtual kiosk bill, but it seems to have less interest to members of the committee. But we will be looking to the will of the committee to move Senate Bill 252 on a committee on Wednesday. And with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:34 p.m.